Case number 12-7103. Bell Helicopter Textron, Inc., a Delaware corporation, and Bell Helicopter Textron Canada, LTD, a Canadian corporation, appellants versus Islamic Republic of Iran, a foreign nation, et al. Mr. Shamagun for the appellants, Mr. Wright for the appellees.
Canon Shanmugam of Williams & Connolly for the Bell Appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court, fully aware of the proceedings in the District Court, Iran chose not to raise its jurisdictional objection before that court entered final judgment. Instead, Iran sought to raise that objection for the first time almost a year later in a Rule 60b-4 motion.
If it speaks to the subject matter jurisdiction, it can't be waived.
That is correct before final judgment, Judge Sentell, but our submission to this court is that the analysis changes once final judgment is entered. And I want to really address both the timeliness issue and the issue of the standard of review, because
except,
I think in some sense
that you're seeking the enforcement of a final judgment, which has no effect if it had no jurisdiction.
Well, this is not itself an enforcement proceeding, Judge Tatel, and it may very well be that in an enforcement proceeding, the analysis is somewhat different, because in the enforcement context, principles of res judicata apply. But under Rule 60b-4, the relevant question is whether the judgment is void. And as numerous courts have held, a judgment is not void simply because it is erroneous. A judgment is void only where there is not even an arguable basis for the court's exercise
of
jurisdiction.
How about if there's no jurisdiction?
Sorry?
I said, how about if there's no jurisdiction? Not just that it's invalid, but that if there's no jurisdiction.
Well, courts have consistently...
No subject matter jurisdiction.
Courts have consistently...
It can't be enforced if the court arguably had jurisdiction, can it?
It can be left in place, because after all, what we're talking about here is a challenge to the judgment itself. Now, it may very well be that in a collateral proceeding, where a party is seeking to enforce the judgment and the other party asserts that there was no jurisdiction, principles of res judicata may enable the party challenging jurisdiction to essentially obtain de novo review. And particularly in the context of personal jurisdiction, the Supreme Court's decision in Insurance Company of Ireland really gives a party that right. But under Rule 60b-4, courts have consistently held that even where the objection is a jurisdictional one, the relevant question is whether there is an arguable basis for the original exercise of jurisdiction. Now, Iran seeks to draw a distinction between cases in which the objecting party did not appear before judgment and cases in which the objecting party did appear before judgment. But in our view, Judge Tatel, and this gets to your question, the error there is that Iran is really conflating principles of res judicata with a relevant inquiry under Rule 60b-4. And again, what it means for a judgment to be void is not simply that the district court erred in its exercise of jurisdiction. And under Iran's view, what it would mean for a judgment...
I don't understand the distinction you're making. The question is, did the district court or did it not have subject matter jurisdiction? That's the only question.
And we would respectfully submit that that isn't actually the appropriate inquiry.
Okay, tell me why.
And again, that is simply because what it means for a judgment to be void is not simply that the district court got it wrong as a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. If that were true, all of the decisions that we cite from, I think, virtually every single one of the regional circuits except the Tenth Circuit would be incorrect. And I don't understand Iran to be contesting the proposition that at least where the party challenging jurisdiction has appeared before judgment, that is the correct inquiry. And the Supreme Court in Espinoza recognized as much, albeit admittedly when it was summarizing the state of law in this area. Iran instead seeks to draw this distinction between cases in which the party does appear and cases in which the party does not appear. And again, our submission to this court is that this is not a res judicata inquiry. And there is a fundamental difference between attempting to enforce a judgment on the one hand and on the other hand an objecting party seeking to wipe out the judgment altogether. Now, again, it may very well be true that if we sought to enforce the judgment in a collateral proceeding and Iran raised its jurisdictional objection, Iran may be entitled to obtain essentially plenary review of that objection. But there's nothing anomalous about that, because the whole point of Rule 60b-4, as with Rule 60b more generally, is to protect the finality and integrity of judgments itself. And that is why Rule 60b...
So under your theory, we would apply the arguable test here, correct?
That is correct.
And if we concluded that there was an arguable basis for jurisdiction and went back to the district court and Iran lost and you sought to enforce the judgment, it could then raise jurisdiction and that would be looked at de novo?
It could. Well, principles of
race. That doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Well, principles
of. Why would we do that?
Well, principles of race judicata would apply at that point. And I would just note parenthetically, Judge Tatel.
Because
that
of what?
Because.
No, but the only question, the only issue that was litigated under my hypothetical is whether or not the district court arguably had jurisdiction.
In a Rule 60b-4 motion, that is correct, Judge Tatel. And so if this court were to apply the arguable basis standard, we would respectfully submit that this court could do so itself and comfortably conclude that there was an arguable basis for Judge Urbina's determination
on
jurisdiction.
Take the rest of my hypothetical. So it goes back to the district court. Iran loses. Can it challenge jurisdiction when you seek to enforce judgment?
It can raise a challenge to jurisdiction, and at that point, the relevant question would be whether res judicata forecloses the objection.
But
now, I want to say a little bit about...
No, but why would res judicata foreclose them if the only question we had answered was whether there's an arguable basis for jurisdiction?
That is correct. So let me explain.
What's correct? What's correct?
Yeah.
That is what this court would determine on a Rule 60b-4 motion.
No, let me make sure. I may keep interrupting you, but I don't... Either I'm not understanding your answers or you're not understanding my hypothetical.
I'm probably not understanding
your
hypothetical.
Let's try again. You want us to apply the arguable basis jurisdiction standard here, correct?
Yes.
Conclude that that there was an arguable basis for jurisdiction. Okay, so let's assume we do that. And we go ahead and rule that on the merits, right?
Yes.
That Bell Helicopter can pursue this under the statute, okay? Goes back to the district court. District court awards damages or something, right?
Yes, the district court's already awarded damages.
Well,
so.
Then at that point, Iran says no jurisdiction. The court didn't. Then what?
If this court were to accept our submission and say that there is an arguable basis for jurisdiction, that would mean reversal of Judge Jackson's order granting the Rule 60b-4 motion. And these proceedings would be at an end because the Rule 60b-4...
But that would effectively revive the judgment entered by Judge Urbina.
That is correct, Judge Rogers. We would have a judgment.
And then Iran says, then they file a motion saying... The district court lacks subject matter jurisdiction.
There are no more motions for Iran to file in this proceeding, Judge Tatel.
No, I'm talking about in the district court.
There's nothing more that Iran can do in the district court.
Well,
Iran's only recourse...
Seek to enforce the judgment.
If we seek to enforce the judgment, it is at that point that Iran could defensively...
That is my question.
Correct.
And what would the standard, what would the question be then?
Well, it would be how res judicata applies. And my understanding of the state of the law as to res judicata, which is, after all, a distinct doctrine, is that to the extent that the objection is a personal jurisdiction objection, the Supreme Court's decision in Insurance Corporation of Ireland, this Court's decisions in Transaero and other cases would allow a party to obtain plenary review. I would note parenthetically, Judge Tatel.
Are we actually talking about personal as opposed to subject matter?
Well, that's where this gets a little bit complicated, Judge Senta.
It's a case, and you've got to get not just the country in the court, but the country in the court on the terms.
And there's frankly a little bit of uncertainty in the law about how res judicata principles apply when the objection is a subject matter jurisdiction objection by virtue.
I hope what Judge Taylor was trying to explore is that
Yes, and so all of which is to say that Iran would doubtless make the argument that because under the FSIA the issue of direct effects goes to both personal and subject matter jurisdiction, it's entitled to plenary review. We would probably make the argument that because the personal jurisdiction inquiry turns entirely on subject matter jurisdiction, they're not entitled to plenary review. But that is a distinct doctrine. And even if it were true, Judge Tatel, I think this hopefully goes right to the heart of your concern. Even if it was true that Iran would be entitled to de novo, that Iran were entitled to de novo review in a collateral proceeding, there's nothing anomalous about that, and there's value to us from having the judgment, regardless of whether we have difficulty in ultimately enforcing it. And again, this just underscores the fact that the inquiry under Rule 60b-4 turns entirely on the question of what it means for a judgment to be void.
You know,
it has nothing.
Can we even act? Don't we actually have to answer the question here? If, let's assume that the, if the district court didn't have jurisdiction, we don't have jurisdiction. Isn't that correct? To hear the appeal?
Well, I don't think that the question here is whether the district court.
I haven't thought about that till just now.
I don't think that the question here is whether the district court somehow had jurisdiction to hear the Rule 60b-4 motion.
No,
I think
the question is whether or not what the standard is the district court uses to determine whether it has subject matter jurisdiction, right?
That is correct. And again, a large list of circuits have held, at least where parties appear, that the arguable basis standard is the correct standard, even where the objection is a jurisdictional one.
How do you distinguish our case in practical
concepts?
Practical concepts,
Judge Tatel, in practical concepts, all this court did was to state the principle with which we don't disagree, that a party that fails to appear before judgment does not thereby forfeit its jurisdictional objection. The court said nothing about the appropriate standard for considering jurisdiction when it is raised on a Rule 60b-4 motion.
But didn't the party in that case argue for a clear usurpation standard, which we rejected? We said the district court properly gave, quote, full consideration to the question?
The plaintiff in practical concepts actually made two arguments. The plaintiff made the argument that Bolivia was entirely foreclosed from raising its jurisdictional objection, and it did also make the argument that a deferential standard of review should be applied. But all this court said, as you note, Judge Tatel, is that the district court properly considered the jurisdictional objection, and the district court, too, really didn't definitively.
More than that, it said it gave full consideration.
Yes, but I don't know that full consideration necessarily goes to the standard of review. And if you take a look at the district court's opinion in practical concepts, the district court really didn't squarely reject the clear usurpation standard. It rejected a case that cited that standard,
that
but it did so.
All the circuits cite the Lubin case. The district court quotes Lubin and says, no, that's where the parties appeared. Then it goes on to say where a party doesn't appear, and then it lists a whole slew of cites, one of which is from this circuit, citing a footnote, where if you trace the cases cited in that footnote, they're talking about this res judicata concept. So that what I'm trying to understand is, and you cite a Second Circuit case and said, you know, we have de novo review over the Rule 60b-4 ruling by the district court, but we should apply this arguable basis standard. Yet, in practical concepts when it came up here, and I'm not disagreeing with you as to what the issue was, nevertheless it said, we agree with the district court having given full consideration, but then it went on almost de novo, did it not, to say, but we disagree with the district court's view that there was jurisdiction under an exception to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
Yeah, and I would just make two points in response on that, Judge Rogers. I do want to say a word with the court's leave on the other issues in the case, but the two things I would say are, first, that it certainly is true that then-Judge Ginsburg's opinion in practical concepts didn't squarely speak to this choice between the two standards of review, at the risk of stating the obvious. Second, with regard to the district court's opinion in practical concepts, I would just note that to the extent that the court quoted the cases that you mentioned, it did so really in the context of rejecting the argument that Bolivia was categorically foreclosed from raising its jurisdictional objection. So I would respectfully submit that that opinion
That's
is a fairly, yeah, it's a fairly thin read on which to rest for the proposition that this court has adopted a de novo standard of review in these circumstances.
And so to belabor this, just so I'm clear, Were we to agree that the arguable basis standard applies in a Rule 60B motion, and we were to rule that Judge Urbina arguably had a basis for jurisdiction, then the status of this case is there is a final valid judgment entered by Judge Urbina. You seek to enforce it. Now, somehow you're saying that Iran then can bring another, as it were, collateral attack on that final judgment on the basis of subject matter jurisdiction?
It could attempt to do so defensively in response to our enforcement effort, and so if we attempted...
And you said it could get plenary review, which, as I understand it, is de novo.
At least as to personal jurisdiction, but then there would be this question about what exactly the objection is and whether the analysis should be different, because in essence, this is really a subject matter jurisdiction objection.
Yeah.
I want to say just a word, if I can, about the timing issue, because we think that that is an independent and, quite frankly, very clean way for this court to dispose of the issue.
But you say in Austin versus Smith, we never dealt with 60 B.C., all right? But we did deal with before.
Well, this court did not so much as cite the reasonable time limitation in Austin. And instead, all that this court did was to reject the argument that the equitable doctrine of latches would provide an independent limitation on motions of this variety. And I would note further that the discussion in Austin itself is pretty clearly dictum. It was introduced by the phrase, it may be suggested that there is a latches problem. Here, we actually went back and took a look at Appley's brief before this court in Austin, and it, too, did not raise a timeliness objection. And so we really don't think that Austin in any way ties this court's hands here. And our submission on Rule 60C1 is really a quite simple one. It's that the plain language of Rule 60C1 really does not admit of any exception for motions under B4. Indeed, Rule 60C1 specifically addresses reasons 1 through 3, which suggests that the framers of the rule were certainly cognizant of the fact that different reasons under Rule 60B might be treated differently, and yet the framers failed to draw any distinctions. And on the merits, I would respectfully submit that we think that the rights that are at issue here, intellectual property rights, are distinct, and that the place of injury when there is a violation of those rights and the rights holder's principal place of business is in the United States is the United States.
So
and in addition,
Wilkover says injury to reputation is just too remote.
But this case involves a claim where the very injury to the right at issue is by definition a reputational injury. And here Judge Urbina found that we had presented evidence sufficient to prevail not only on our claim of trade dress infringement, but also on our claim of blurring by dilution by blurring and by tarnishment. And in addition, we presented evidence that those requisite effects, in fact, occurred in the United States. And while it is true that Iran can't sell its helicopters in the United States, we nevertheless presented evidence that the reputational harms at issue here, again, harms that go to not just the likelihood of consumer confusion, but also the association of our trade dress with our products, and the positive associations that people have with that trade dress, were in fact felt in the United States. That's the testimony.
Is there any evidence in the record of a entity, foreign country, or a foreign corporation buying an Iranian-produced helicopter that could have purchased a Bell helicopter? Do you see my point? Is there any evidence of that at all?
Judge Jackson, in her order, Judge Tatel, suggested that what was going on here were really two separate markets. And so she suggested that Iran sells its helicopters in the third world and that Bell sells its helicopters only in the developed world. But in fact, the evidence in the record suggested first that Bell really does sell its helicopters worldwide. It was somewhat inferential evidence.
My question was a very specific one about the record. Is there any evidence of any purchaser, anybody, any entity purchasing, either actually purchased an Iranian helicopter or could have purchased an Iranian helicopter that could also have purchased a Bell helicopter?
The evidence in the record, Judge Tatel, was that Iran was making its helicopters available at air shows that were being attended by...
So the answer to my question is no?
Oh, I think the answer is that to the extent that there's evidence in the record, it suggests yes, because there were individuals from other countries who were coming to this air show. And in addition, the evidence...
But is there any evidence of a company, of a specific one, that could have purchased an Iranian... that did purchase or could have purchased an Iranian helicopter, but didn't? I mean, that did, even though it could have purchased a Bell helicopter. That's my only question.
Yeah, and
I know there were people from all over the world at these...
And there were no invoices or anything like that, and as you might imagine, it's rather difficult, given the nature of this litigation, for us to come into possession of that evidence. The specific evidence in the record was that Iran was marketing these helicopters. There was no suggestion that Iran and Bell are somehow competing in wholly separate markets, and if that were true, perhaps the analysis would be different. Well, and instead, we showed that Iran had manufactured 13 of these helicopters, and Judge Urbina awarded us damages, in essence,
for... But if you can't get anywhere with Judge Urbina's decision if you're wrong about the arguable standard, correct?
We think we would prevail even under a de novo standard, but we think it's
let's
easy.
Assume for purposes of your argument that we don't agree with you and that this is a de novo standard. We're looking at the record before Judge Jackson now.
Well, the record before Judge Urbina, which Judge Jackson proceeded to review, because there was no other evidence before Judge Jackson. And I would respectfully submit that to the extent that there was that evidence, and keep in mind that Iran presented...
What is the best evidence that you have that there was actual displacement, that there were entities purchasing these helicopters that could have purchased Bell helicopters?
Again, we don't have invoices. All we have is evidence that there were 13 such helicopters, and those were the helicopters on which Judge Urbina awarded damages, and that Iran was making those helicopters available at air shows. This was not a situation in which Iran was simply manufacturing them, say, for internal government use. And again, the testimony of Vernon Albert, the aviation consultant whose testimony was really the primary testimony before Judge Urbina, suggested that, in essence, this is a worldwide market.
But your own allegation is that the Iranian helicopters are cheaper and of lower quality.
That is correct, and that is precisely why the very existence of these helicopters causes the reputational harms that were at the heart of our dilution claim. And it's important, Judge Tatel, I think,
to keep... suggests that entities seeking high-quality helicopters would not buy the Iranian helicopters?
Well, but there was evidence that there are those, particularly in the Third World, and that's not my term, that was the term that was used in the proceedings before the district court, might purchase these cheaper helicopters, and there was further abundant evidence
might. But we're dealing with the direct consequences language of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, then.
But keep in mind, Judge...
I don't think you can prevail on mites.
But keep in mind, Judge Tatel, that we're not here to defend, say, the damages award on an infringement claim. Right. We had claims of infringement and blurring. Uh-huh. Judge Urbina found in our favor on those claims. And I would note that on the merits, Judge Urbina's determinations are preclusive, because those certainly can't be challenged on a Rule 60b-4 motion raising a jurisdictional objection. And the harms that we suffered here don't require an actual sale, Judge Tatel. In particular, the harms that we suffered on our dilution claim, blurring and tarnishing of our brand reputation, are harms that, in our view, occurred just as soon as Iran began marketing this helicopter. And we presented abundant evidence that whenever there is a rival helicopter out there on the market that is essentially indistinguishable from our helicopter, that the spare parts market is such that parts from those helicopters will inevitably find their way into our helicopters.
I was going to ask you about the spare parts. There's no evidence of the spare parts actually working their way into the U.S. market, right? It could.
That's right. But again, we're not trying to show, you know, that actual injuries occurred here.
Is that a direct injury in the United States, if you think that it's possible or even likely that there might someday be some spare parts and find its way in?
Yes, because the injury that we're seeking to vindicate here is a reputational injury. It is the diminution in the affirmative associations of our trade dress and the identification of that trade dress with our product. And so, for instance, you know, it might very well be that if this were litigated anew, let's suppose that there were no sales and that we had a claim purely for injunctive relief. The nature of the underlying injury really wouldn't change. In other words, our argument as to direct effects here is really not wholly dependent on the fact that Judge Rubina awarded to us $19.5 million in damages for... That is correct. And we think that the implication of Iran's position here is really that no act of intentional infringement or dilution that takes place abroad would be sufficient to give rise to direct effects under the commercial activity exception. The only way in which the commercial activity exception...
If you're saying that, you're saying there's been no showing here of any direct effect by this particular...
Well, but I think that the implication of their position, and Mr. Wright can disabuse me of this notion if I'm wrong, is that really you have to have a sale of the product into the United States. And, of course, the first two prongs of the commercial activity exception deal with that situation. They deal with a situation in which the commercial activity actually occurs in the United States. Our submission is simply that absent an unusual situation in which, for instance, the product is produced and sold for, say, a domestic market that we don't participate in and can't enter, absent a situation like that, we really think that the situs of injury when there is an intellectual property violation of this variety is where the rights holder is located. And again, in addition, we presented the testimony of Mr. Albert demonstrating that those reputational effects were occurring in the United States among individuals in the United States. And that would be sufficient, Judge Tatel, under any standard of review, but certainly under the arguable basis standard, in light of the fact that no court of appeals has addressed the application of the commercial activity exception to intellectual property rights of this variety, we think that it's an easy case.
Thank you. Let's hear from Appley.
May it please the court, I'm Christopher Wright representing Iran. On the Rule 60B4 issue, I'm not sure I have anything to add. It seems to me that the court recognized the weakness in the position presented. The one thing that was new here today was the concession that at some later point we could bring this, and I would add my view that that doesn't seem very sensible to let us raise the argument later and not let us raise it today. So I'll move on to direct effects. And I would just say that, you know, in the joint appendix at page 303, Judge Jackson said that Iran's helicopters are not sold in the United States, but only in the third world, so there must be, quote, a chain of events involving a series of independent third-party actors, including third-world operators, who have to intend to buy what they believe are Bell products and then go on and actually purchase the Iranian helicopters by mistake. That is not a direct effect. That is a terrific example, as Judge Jackson concluded, of an indirect effect.
Suppose there was evidence in the record that country A had purchased an Iranian helicopter, but it could have purchased a Bell helicopter.
We don't think there's any evidence.
I know. That's why I started the word sentence with if.
I don't think there is anything in the record.
That's what I said. There isn't. Yeah. There isn't. That's why I started the question with if.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I apologize. Yeah. If there was evidence, yeah. I would think there would have to be evidence. Well, first, a two-part answer. There would have to be evidence in the record that someone, I think, bought an Iranian helicopter thinking it was a Bell helicopter, and there's certainly no evidence saying that, and at least it seems rather implausible that you wouldn't know who was making the helicopter you bought.
The thrust of the hypothetical was that someone would have bought Bell had they known the safety problems with the Iranian helicopter or something like that. It didn't have to be an actual purchase.
All right. Well, let me say that, first of all, in this hypothetical, if everything happened overseas and nothing happened in the United States, I think it's an indirect effect under the direct effects test. Judge Rogers, your hypothetical.
Well, what about Weltover? I mean, the payment didn't happen in the United States.
There was a payment scheduled to be to happen in the United States,
okay, so
that the Argentinian government canceled.
Is what is the effect?
Right.
And, I see. Is there no case? Can you think of no case where everything occurred outside the United States, yet we found effects inside the United States? There's no such case that you know of?
Well, I would say that Weltover and the Cruise Connections case from 2010 that you wrote on behalf of the court, the sort of key things were payments that were scheduled to happen automatically in the United States that didn't happen. Here, of course, again, it's very indirect. Mm-hmm. Someone would have to go to some other country and not buy a Bell helicopter on account of confusion, and then the money wouldn't come to the United States. The way this test has been phrased as requiring immediate action I think in your case you spoke of it as leading inexorably to a result in the United States, and that there were done deals that were canceled. We're not even close to that here.
Well, counsel's arguing that in intellectual property you're in a different realm of analysis.
Okay. Indeed, they argue that the direct effects of test, you know, is always met in intellectual property cases.
And yours is that it's never met.
The closest case, as you pointed out, is the reputational harm in Weltover, where the mm-hmm. Supreme Court rejected it. I would say that I really don't understand the argument to work. Any legal harm could... A good lawyer could stand up and say that I was immediately harmed by any legal harm anywhere in the world that impinged on my legal rights, and therefore I always suffer a direct effect, and I don't understand how intellectual property is any different than any other legal right or wrong. If there are no further questions from the court, thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant.
I just want to say a word, may it please the court, about the fundamental fallacy of what Mr. Wright has just said. Mr. Wright suggested that it really is our burden to come forward with evidence that a consumer was actually confused. And, of course, that is one way that an individual could show trademark infringement. But, of course, trademark infringement requires only a likelihood of confusion.
I thought he was speaking to direct effect when he said that, rather than whether there might be a claim for relief somewhere in the world.
Well, Judge Santel, I don't understand Mr. Wright to concede from his answer to Judge Rogers' question that even where you had a consumer outside the United States who was actually confused, you would have the requisite direct effects. And here's why I think that there really is a fallacy with that line of reasoning. The line of reasoning appears to be that even if you have that actual confusion outside the United States, the fact that you have an intervening consumer somehow constitutes the intervening act that breaks the causal chain, if you will, and renders an effect indirect. Our submission is that you don't even need to have that intervening consumer, because all you need to have for a trademark infringement claim is a likelihood of confusion. And all you have to have for a trademark dilution claim is something less than that. A reputational harm, sort of a junior varsity version of trademark infringement as it has been described, whereby the association of the mark with the product is somehow impaired. And to present really the key piece of evidence, and if there's one thing in the record before Judge Urbina I would urge this court to look at, It's a testimony of Vernon Albert starting at page 62 of the appendix, where I promoted him. Mr. Albert says when he first saw pictures of the counterfeit helicopters, he thought either that, quote, Bell was allowing someone else a license to build its aircraft, or that the aircraft was a new modified Bell product. And again, even absent any sales of the helicopter abroad or any intervention by a consumer, that reputational harm is felt as soon as Iran begins displaying its copycat helicopters. And Mr. Albert's testimony demonstrates that that effect was in fact felt in the United States, separate and apart from the mere fact that, by virtue of the fact that the rights holder is here in the United States, there is a direct effect. So again, our submission before this court is that the motion was untimely, that Iran has made no effort to offer a justification for its delay in raising the objection, but should this court conclude otherwise, it should apply the arguable basis standard and conclude that under these circumstances, there was plainly at least an arguable basis for the district court's exercise of jurisdiction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.